I'm Roy Bonestell. Tonight's Man Alive begins its 20th season. Over the years, we've met many outstanding people, spiritual leaders to individuals with courage and endurance. I'm about to meet one of the most glamorous and mysterious men in the world. He is His Highness the Aga Khan. We in the West know him only as a fabulous rich man, owner of the finest racehorses in the world. Some race here at the famous Chantilly track, near his estate in France.
Aiglemont, outside Paris, the principal residence of His Highness the Aga Khan. This is the first time the Aga Khan has agreed to a personal interview on North American television.
Thank you very much.
What most of us don't know is that for the past 30 years, His Highness the Aga Khan has quietly and carefully constructed a multinational financial and philanthropic empire along Islamic principles. For more than 15 million Muslims, the Aga Khan is their spiritual leader, their living imam. We are familiar with three generations of the Aga Khan's family. We particularly remember the image of his grandfather being weighed in diamonds. What we don't know is that the diamonds were rented for the occasion to symbolize the donations given to him by his followers. It was the Ismailis' unique way of redistributing wealth. The money was not used to indulge his personal passions, but rather to build hospitals and schools for some of the poorest in the world. You remember his son, Ali Khan, whose second marriage was to Hollywood actress Rita Hayworth. He was a dashing man with extravagant tastes, and he was not shy of publicity. When it came to choosing his successor, the grandfather skipped over both of his sons and designated one of his grandsons, Karim, to hold the sacred office, to be the spiritual leader, the imam. He was a student at Harvard when his grandfather died. At the age of 20, Prince Karim Aga Khan became the 49th Imam of the Ismailis. 15 million followers spread throughout 25 countries believe that the Aga Khan is a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. He is responsible for the spiritual guidance and the well-being of the Ismaili community. After 30 years in office, he is the world's most modern Muslim leader, a bridge between East and West.
You are called the living imam. What exactly does that mean?
Well, Shia history has followed the same sort of historical developments as all hereditary offices have followed, where there have been differences of opinion on who was the legitimate successor to the predecessor, whether it was a secular or a religious office. In the case of the Shia Muslims, the Shia branch of Islam split, and one branch of the Shia Muslims accepted the concept of the imam in hiding, because or the invisible imam, because the 12th imam disappeared as a very young child. And our branch of Shia Islam, in that particular generation of the family, accepted the legitimacy of the eldest son, Ismail, as being reappointed imam to succeed, and that's why they are known as Ismailis. And that branch of the family has continued today hereditarily. That's why there is a living imam for the Ismaili Muslims.
How do you see your responsibility as the living imam?
Well, the imam is, first of all, obviously responsible for the interpretation and practice of the faith. And that is a role which my grandfather fulfilled, which I fulfill today. Secondly, and the imam's decisions with regard to matters of faith are binding, obviously, on members of the community.
Is this a kind of divine authority?
You have to be very careful not to confuse the concept of religious authority with divinity.
Mm-hmm.
The Prophet himself never claimed any miracle of any sort. The only miracle which you have in Islam is the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
You don't fit the image we have in the West of
Muslim leader. No beard, no turban, no flowing robes. You are considered to be the model of a modern Muslim.
There has been an incomprehension of the essence of the faith in the sense that very often the industrialized world, the Western world, has looked at the quaint, the unusual, and has tried to highlight, for whatever reason, those aspects of the Islamic world's the way it presents itself. The Islamic world itself has not always clarified what it is about. It has found it difficult to express itself. And so I don't want to appear to say that the incomprehensions that have occurred can be attributed unilaterally to one world rather than the other. I think what is important is that in learning about the Islamic world, the Western world should try to be better informed about the essence of the faith and not be too hypnotized by certain exterior forms which are maybe limited in their geographic influence, they may be limited in time. Things that are happening today, 20 years hence, will appear to be of no consequence whatsoever.
Another image we have is of the Ayatollah, and we associate Islam with terrorism. Is terrorism Islamic?
Certainly isn't. Unfortunately, it is a part of our modern life. In fact, it's also part of our history. But it's prevalent in Western Europe. It's prevalent in South America. It takes religious expressions. It takes economic expressions. I don't think one should, in all honesty, look at terrorism as being an Islamic force. I don't think it is in any way an Islamic force. It is an expression of other forces which may seek at times to use Islam as one of the binding ingredients, just as I think other terrorist forms in Western Europe, for example, do the same thing. The IRA can hardly be expressive of the Catholic Church, and yet it calls itself a Catholic movement. So I think we have to be careful not to attach to the term terrorism a religious connotation par excellence. That there are elements in those forces of terrorism which may seek legitimacy from a faith is something which is worldwide, not specific to the Islamic world.
In the harsh and complex world of international politics, the Aga Khan works quietly in the background. He cleverly maintains a delicate balance between his role as a religious leader, philanthropist, and statesman. There are over 50,000 Ismailis living in Canada today. It was the Aga Khan who opened the first multiracial schools in Africa. Yet, under Idi Amin's crazed racial and economic policies, all Ismailis were expelled from Uganda in August 72. In a matter of days, 15,000 Ismailis, most of them successful professionals and businessmen and women, became refugees. Some 10,000 found a new home in Canada with the Aga Khan's assistance.
I felt that it was part of the responsibility of the imamate to assist this community to settle in other parts of the world. We have always, from my grandfather's time, even before then, sought to act in a strong, a courageous manner. I didn't feel that these manners should be looked upon by any country that was going to receive them as a potentially weak, unstable minority that would bring more problems than it would bring advantages. And I was able to use imamate institutional support with the banking network in Canada to provide specialized programs of support to the community in Canada, in Britain, and elsewhere.
But your leadership wasn't just spiritual. There was also financial support there, too. Tell me,
Does the community still tithe to you?
There is a, like in, I think, all faiths, a form of religious due, which is voluntary, which is institutional income. It is given within the context of the link between the imam of the time and the individual or the family. And I think that it has been a source of strength both to the community and to the institution, so long as those resources are used in a manner which is appropriate to the role of the imam as an institution and is understood as such.
A $400 million hospital in Pakistan, built with international and Ismaili support. Like his grandfather and the symbolic diamond, the Aga Khan redistributes community funds. Throughout the Third World, schools, clinics, and hospitals serve the local communities as well as the Ismailis. But all this development is driven by another vision, architecture, which incorporates Islamic principles and emphasizes the human scale.
You're quite concerned about scale in your architectural design.
I think one of the issues in the Islamic faith is the relationship of man to his environment and not to become invading in attitude to that environment, not becoming vain or seeking to overlord others. And there has been, I think, a tendency in the industrialized world sometimes to build buildings for prestige and for high visibility.
The Ismaili Center in London, England, this elegant building reflects the theological principles of Islamic design. In Vancouver, another Ismaili center. The Aga Khan's expertise makes him one of the world's most respected patrons of architecture. His international award is one of the most coveted architectural prizes. Comedian Bruno Fuschi was selected to build the Vancouver Center.
Why him? Why not an Islamic architect?
Where we build in the industrialized world, I've tried to use architects who were of that world, who knew what the planning concerns might be, the productive concerns of contractors, and who had the sensitivity to be able to design in our culture, in our idiom. And from the first as I made the point at the time, he's rather a remarkable man.
He said that you were such a great inspiration to him. I'm wondering, what did you instruct him, or how did you inspire him in that way? He must have had long discussions about your ideas.
Yes, I think I've always tried to share with people who work on architectural projects for the community and me some explanation of what we're trying to get out of the building. It's not just the bricks and mortar.
The architect who works most closely with him and shares his vision is Hassan Khan.
He has a dream. He has a vision of the future, of where people may be 50 to 100 years from now, where people will be involved in making their own decisions, where people will have a better quality of life.
Realizing the Aga Khan's dreams is also a matter of careful management and administration. The main offices of his unorthodox multinational are at Aigrement, his estate near Paris. Over 100 people of differing nationalities and faiths work here on everything from horse breeding to health care, education, and financial planning. His chief financial man is an Australian, William Robinson. How do you make your decisions about investments, sir? Is it like any other business?
I would like to say it is, but I don't think that's the truth. I think you can see our whole organization, or the Aga Khan's organization, is almost being more akin to that of a government than a normal multinational, if I can use that term. What the main differences are, I think, that the purpose behind the investments, profit, there are a number of investments in the commercials are which are, whose profit is a factor, but it's not the only factor, and we wouldn't be making those investments for profit alone. In the Third World, I think you've really got to go back to the purpose of his activity, whether it's in the health, the education, housing, social welfare side, or if you look at the economic side, it's basically there in the first instance to give material and economic support to his own community. But because his own community is very much, their own future is very much tied up in the country in which they live, the programs that he has in those countries, whether they're in health or education or straight commercial investments, are targeted more at the country than the Israeli community. So overall, I mean, we're not like a normal organization. In the commercial investments, we do look for profit, but we take a much, much longer view.
What's His Highness the Aga Khan like to work for?
Well, as a person, he's very, very different to the one of the popular images, which is of someone being fairly exotic. I mean, nothing could be farther from the truth. He's actually very, very hardworking, perhaps almost driven sometimes. Takes a very long view of things, which he's in a position to do because of his fairly unique position. By and large, he's an excellent boss.
I think, again, it comes back to the motivation. I just don't believe that people are entirely motivated by greed or power or that sort of thing. I think they give the best of themselves if they contribute from all aspects of their being, their own aspirations. If they see that they're sharing things with people, which isn't only knowledge or which isn't only material things, the sharing of knowledge, the ability to see results is, I think, a very important thing. And I do pay attention to detail because I think ultimately one should address an issue once and try and get it right and not have to come back because you've been slipshod or because you haven't taken into account something which you could have foreseen. There's so much that has to be done. It's better, I think, to try and do it once properly.
As a businessman, what are your goals and ideals?
As an individual entrepreneur, I'm not particularly inspired by business. What I have inherited, I have tried to manage appropriately. But I have no particular aspiration to be a major entrepreneur in my own right. I do attach very great importance to the longevity and good management of community institutions.
But you do want to make a profit.
You want to make profits so that those institutions can grow and serve an increasingly wide spectrum. But you want to avoid greed. You want to avoid malpractice. You want to contribute to an environment which is an ethical environment, but within the context of freedom of enterprise.
You say you get no thrill out of being a businessman, but that's what we know you mostly for in the West. Your hotels, your horses, your resorts.
Well, I sometimes wonder what one can do about it in the sense that, you know, I certainly have no control over people, what people write and think. I think they tend to look at their own back garden first, and therefore the Western media are more concerned with what is happening in the Western world than what's happening in the developing world. I think that's changing. What I would emphasize is that both the bloodstock activities and the tourism activities are accidents in my life, in the sense that the bloodstock activity has been a family tradition. When my father died, the question was whether that would continue or not. It was a successful and I think a happy tradition, and it seemed to me that there was no fundamental reason not to continue it so long as I could try and keep it at a perfect level. Of course, as Marla started through a very small personal investment with about 20 other people in an island in the Mediterranean, and for historical reasons which still aren't going to hear, it grew into an enterprise, and from an enterprise it became quite a substantial commitment to tourism in the industrialized world. Now that probably one day will, through its own momentum, come to be an important prop for our development efforts in the third world.
There seems to be a contradiction here with your jet-set hotels and horses and your concern for the environment in the third world. And yet, you don't really seek much publicity
No.
for the development work you do.
No. I think it would be extremely unwise to spend one's time collecting images, which are images of the Western world, which is not probably my area of concern. I think it's much more productive, frankly, that I devote the time that I have to the developing world, to the mandate which I have to complete the work, you know, to try to complete the work that needs to be done. I think if you were to ask questions about what the outcome was in India or Pakistan or East Africa, you'd get a totally different answer from what you would hear. That must be my concern.
There is not an aid agency that I know, and we've talked to a lot of them, that does not respect your work in the third world. It must be this emphasis on management.
Oh, I think there are many other factors that contribute to it also. I think one is that the motivations behind the exercises are very strongly shared by the people who work in them. In that sense, there's an integrity of approach which is not only based on the results, it's based on the moral convictions of the people who are working in those activities. And one of the most difficult questions I ask, and I've asked it I don't know how many times, is simple. What is the definition of happiness for a peasant in Asia or Africa? If we can't answer that question, and we don't know what are the elements that contribute and the priorities of those elements, we certainly will never be able to deal with the development issue in a manner which is going to be shared by the people we're working with, taken over and made theirs.
You talk about happiness in the third world. What's happiness to you?
I think happiness, from my point of view, would be seeing that some of the things one has sought to achieve with the leadership in the community, the institutions in the community, people outside the community, are beginning to produce some of the results one was aspiring for. And that isn't only in material terms, it's also very much in terms of the way societies function, the way opportunity is created. But that's very important.
We see you with heads of state, and yet you're not a politician. You're in business, and yet you're more than a businessman, and certainly a religious leader, and yet more than that. How do you want to be remembered?
Probably not in name or face. I'd far prefer that certain important things that occurred during my mandate should continue. Relations between the Ismaili community, other parts of the Islamic Ummah, between the Islamic world and the non-Islamic world. Certain concepts of the unity of man, that you don't serve yourself best by being mean and inward looking, and you don't serve your future generations that way. There are those who enter the world in such poverty that they are deprived of both the means and the motivation to improve their lot. Unless these unfortunates can be touched with the spark which ignites the spirit of individual enterprise and determination, they will only sink back into renewed apathy, degradation, and despair. It is for us, who are more fortunate, to provide that spark. A proper home can provide the bridge across that terrible gulf between utter poverty and the possibility of a better future.